Crowns, palaces, and elaborate ceremonies. But what are they really? Most view the Queen as a benign old lady and symbol of England, but deeper research shows she and the royal family are nothing but a ruthless criminal gang whose enormous wealth, built on the suffering of millions, remains a state secret to this day. With the royal family's considerable media influence, it's easy to get caught up in the romance and pageantry. But beneath the gilded palace gates lies a hidden world of scandals, Nazis, murder, and even cannibalism. Queen Elizabeth II, one of the most influential and recognizable people alive today. Most think of UK's royal family as purely symbolic, with no real power. This notion, however, could not be further from the truth. While the United States fought a lengthy war to gain independence, nations such as North Ireland, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand never fully gained complete sovereignty from the crown. Apart from ribbon-cutting and picture-taking, the Queen is actually head of state in all Commonwealth nations and possesses the power to dismiss and appoint new prime ministers and parliament members. She can command armed forces, refuse parliamentary legislation, pardon convicted criminals, and even declare a state of emergency. In fact, all leaders of Commonwealth states, such as UK, Canada, and Australia, swear allegiance not to the people who elected them, but the Queen. This even applies to judges, lawyers, and police.
Mr. Speaker, the Queen commands this Honourable House to attend Her Majesty immediately in the House of Peers.
Canadian warships are called HMCS, or Her Majesty's Canadian Ships. In Australia, it's Her Majesty's Australian Ship. Canadian police are known as Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The UK Prime Minister even consults with the Queen once a week. No record is kept of these legendary meetings, despite their obvious influence on public affairs.
The Queen is legally entitled to meet the Prime Minister once a week. If she can't meet him in person, she's allowed a telephone conversation. During these meetings, she's allowed to discuss anything she wishes, any matter at all. However, whatever she does discuss is kept completely confidential from the rest of the public. We do not have a right to know what she discusses on her behalf.
With wealth comes power, specifically the power not to obey the laws of the land in the way that every other citizen of the country is required to do. The Prince of Wales, Duchy of Cornwall is not, for instance, subject to planning permission or planning consent in the way that any other builder would be. This means that Charles can avoid fines of up to £50,000 that would be levied against anyone else breaking these planning laws. Every other landlord has to grant squatters' rights if they occupy land for 10 years. But for the Prince, that time limit is 60 years. Normally, landlords must allow their leaseholders to buy the freehold on a property. But not the Prince, who can hold leaseholders in that condition forever. The Duchy only pays tax voluntarily and has free advice from government lawyers. It also benefits from exemptions that no other private sector body enjoys. For instance, Charles pays no corporation tax or capital gains tax on his business enterprises.
As a reminder of her enormous power, Commonwealth nations even display the Queen on their currency. While many are unaware of such powers, most of those who are view these powers as emblematic. In reality, not only are these powers genuine, she has flexed this inherited power in the not-so-distant past. Australia, 1975. The government is hopelessly gridlocked on the new budget. With the clock running out, the government goes into shutdown, similar to the US shutdown in 2013. Except in this case, things ended much differently. Instead of a two-week-long shutdown, the Australian Governor-General, acting on behalf of the Queen, dismissed and replaced the sitting Prime Minister. The next day, after the controversial spending bill was passed, he fired all of Parliament and held new elections to replace them. Not only does she have the power, she's not afraid to use it. Everyone knows the Queen is rich. But just how wealthy the 90-year-old is might surprise you. While looking at the names of the richest people alive, you will see names like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Carlos Slim. However, the true wealth of the Queen is hidden in private trusts and even in the monarchy itself. A casual search of the Queen's net worth reveals a sum around $600 million. This wealth is astonishing by anyone's standards, but her true wealth is absolutely mind-blowing. By allowing assets to be owned by the monarchy, the royal family can conceal their true value while still ensuring their wealth is passed on to their heir. The truth is, her actual net worth is in the trillions. She still owns 89% of Canadian land called Crown Land, which is administered by various government agencies and departments on behalf of the Queen. She essentially leases it out to her own people and receives a percentage of the funds.
The largest landowners in Britain is the Crown Estate. They own a combined property portfolio of around £8.1 billion. That includes agricultural land as well as urban properties. And this isn't the monarch's personal private land, but she receives an annual percentage revenue from this every year.
Canadians are not land owners, they are land holders. This is a big difference. Aside from her enormous land ownership in Canada, she also owns 50% of UK coastline, all of Regent Street, and is rumored to own parts of Manhattan.
Crown land is some of the most valuable in the country. Indeed, the value of the Crown's urban property, £4 billion, is four times greater than the value of its rural land holdings. The Crown owns, for instance, the entirety of Regent Street, around half of St James's in London's West End, and retail property across the UK, including in Oxford, Exeter, Nottingham, Newcastle and Harlow. The Crown owns part of the Bluewater retail park in Kent. It also owns retail parks in Leeds, Milton Keynes, Merseyside, Slough, Swansea, Portsmouth, Harlow, Maidstone, Hemel Hempstead, Nottingham, Edinburgh, Warwick, Cheltenham and Jersey. The Windsor Estate controls Ascot Racecourse, golf clubs, hotels, farms and woodland. In Scotland, the Crown owns fishing rights on many rivers, oyster and mussel fishing revenues and mining rights throughout its holdings.
The feudal Cornwall laws are pretty much an archaic and medieval-like remnant from kings and queens past. It allows the Duchy of Cornwall, that's the Prince of Wales's personal estate, to work as a separate legal jurisdiction. So that means that the Prince of Wales cannot be summoned in any of Her Majesty's courts. It means that he cannot be legally summoned to pay tax. And it means he's able to veto any law passed by government which may affect his private interests. And we know he has done this 12 times already.
She secretly held a major share in a large Mississippi plantation called the Delta Pine and Land Company until two U.S. congressmen blew the whistle on her and her use of a company called Courtlands, as in Courtlands Textiles, to hide her shares in the plantation known locally as the Queen's Plantation. Aside from a jaw-dropping real estate portfolio worth an estimated £17 trillion, her assets include a solid gold carriage weighing over 4 tons, 27,000 masterpieces, Rolls Royces and Bentleys. But her stolen riches could not be better exemplified than by the very jewels and diamonds the Queen wears. Fabulous pieces, legendary diamonds, and historical regalia worth untold billions. Her jewelry collection contains over 16 diamond jewel crowns, one of which contains a special diamond broken from the largest diamond ever found, known as the Star of Africa, and another diamond, known as the Kohinoor Diamond, a piece of myth and legend in India, which fell from one emperor and conqueror to another for centuries before finally being given to Queen Victoria by a 10-year-old Maharaja. The crown jewels are so secretive, they are never allowed to be studied, even by experts, and the jewelry collection's worth remains unknown. But how could one family amass trillions in assets? The answer lies in the enormous power their family has leveraged throughout the past century. Some of their wealth has been stolen from their own taxpayers. However, much of it was taken from the many colonies her family once owned entirely. Many of these places contained enormous natural resources, which were exploited and sold with little regard to the native peoples, as is the case with the diamond known as the Star of Africa, which she wears on her crown. Still, much of her wealth comes from even more dubious sources. The English royal family had a great connection with slavery, starting from Elizabeth I. The Duke of York used to get his initials DY branded onto the left buttock or breast of each of the 3,000 slaves who were his. In 1624, the English colonized Barbados and St. Kitts, and approximately 23 years later, the first sugar from Barbados was sent to England. England captured Jamaica from the Spanish, and the slave trade had yet another place in which to thrive. Elizabeth I established the Royal African Company to facilitate the transport and sale of slaves, which would thrive up until the dawn of the 18th century. But the wealth they obtained from selling African lives would be chump change compared to the haul they would soon make on China. The royal family joined with the East India Trading Company to import into China. The number one import, opium.
The drug was illegal in China, though the ban was widely ignored. There were an estimated 12 million peasants addicted to opium. The authorities there called it a deadly poison ruining the minds and morals of our people. The British grew opium poppies in India. There they processed it in factories on a colossal scale. Finally, it was shipped to China and sold to smugglers.
Almost 13% of the income of India under British rule was derived from the sale of good quality Bengal opium to British-run opium distributors in China.
In 1839, the Chinese emperor decided he'd had enough. He ordered more than 1,000 tons of British-supplied opium to be seized and destroyed. The opium wars were about to begin. Britain's first ocean-going iron warship, the Nemesis, built in Liverpool, was sent out to take on the Emperor's navy. It helped destroy much of it in a single afternoon.
This was the modern world confronting an ancient one, sailing junks against steam-driven gunboats. The Chinese had no choice but to surrender and to open 5 ports to British trade.
Ultimately, the Chinese people would fight 2 devastating wars to rid themselves of the British imported opium and put an end to the addiction crisis which for so long had ravaged their population. The British monarchy, which is not British as we will soon show, has amassed a great fortune off their own people and the colonies they controlled. Exactly how much, however, is officially a state secret. That's right, the royal family's net worth is confidential and exempt from any freedom of information request, but experts estimate it at over $32 trillion. While the UK tax rate can be over 40% for high-income earners, the British royal family can pretty much pay whatever they like. For hundreds of years, the royal family paid no income tax whatsoever. After all, they're kings. They collect taxes. But in 1992, under mounting pressure, the Queen begrudgingly volunteered to pay income and capital gains tax. However, she is exempt from any freedom of information laws, and all inquiries into how much the royal family pays, if any, have been declined.
If it's personal wealth, you'd expect someone who was resident in the UK for tax purposes, which you'd like to imagine that the head of state of the United Kingdom was regarded as being a resident of the UK, although admittedly she's the head of state of a number of other countries as well. But you'd like to imagine that that person might be expected to pay regular tax on what is after all their personal income, but they don't. They don't have a normal tax arrangement. They have paid tax, but it's not done in the standard way. And we just don't really know what exactly their personal wealth is, and it's clouded to a large extent.
Also, consider that while she commands great wealth, Much of it is owned in a trust for her heirs, which she then controls. No inheritance tax, not counted as part of a massive net worth, and she still has access anytime she wants and can pass it on to whomever she wants. Sound like ownership to you? While they may not be so quick to pay taxes, the royal family is certainly not shy about collecting.
There's a thing called the civil list, which is the kind of the money voted to them by Parliament to support the Queen and various of her relatives in their public duties. There are also various other expenses that come out of public money associated with their public duties, which aren't necessarily as clearly visible in public accounts. And then, of course, there's the question of what's regarded as being their own personal wealth.
The Prince of Wales, he doesn't lift a thing. He gets up in the morning, his bathrobe is there waiting for him. He walks into the bathroom, the bath is drawn for him already. Well, even when he gets out of the bath, the towel is folded in a special way so that he just has to sit in it and wrap it around him. Then he goes into his dressing room, his clothes are all laid out for him. Even his socks, left and right, are in exactly the right spot.
For the privilege of being ruled by inbred Romanian swine, the British taxpayer foots the bill for security, hundreds of servants and waitstaff, utilities on palaces, and even personal royal salaries.
Charles likes, he has a particular dish he likes to eat when he goes out hunting, which is softly boiled eggs and Scotch whiskey, waiting for him when he comes back. But of course, they never know when he's coming back. So a good half an hour before he's due back, they start boiling up a batch of 20 eggs, 3 minutes exactly. And then if he hasn't arrived in those 3 minutes, they throw them away. Then they start another batch and another batch, and you can get through 100 eggs before the Prince of Wales actually comes home.
The official figure cited the amount at only £32 million, when in reality it was over £202 million per year. UK pensioners are expected to live on less and less, meanwhile these greedy parasites are paying their heating bills with taxpayer money.
According to official figures, taxpayers' funding to the royal household last year was £32 million, but an investigation by the campaign group Republic discovered substantial hidden costs of maintaining a royal family. The true cost of the monarchy to the taxpayer is said to be more than six times the official sum, at £202 million. The expenditure that's not revealed to the public includes the high cost of security, travel and receptions by local councils for members of the royal family. Buckingham Palace says the Queen spends over £10 million a year on servants and entertaining 50,000 guests, mostly feeding them afternoon tea in the palace gardens. Taxpayers also pay the Queen £16 million for the upkeep of her palaces and another £4 million towards travel expenses.
Their money comes really from two sources, mainly perhaps from us, from ordinary British people, and also from the income from the investments that they've stacked up from previous theft from ourselves and across the globe. So that's where their money comes from, and that's a very important arena of political debate. The Queen gets a great deal of money from the British taxpayer, and for me, at a time of austerity, that's a particularly gross distortion of where our money should be going. We're told on a daily basis that there isn't enough money for disabled people on benefits, for job creation, for vital services like health and education, and yet at the same time, the Queen and the rest of the royal family managed to rack up £180 million, £200 million in all, a significant portion of which comes directly from the British taxpayer. And at a time when we're being told we have to cut back all the time, that seems to me extraordinary, that those people get that money with really no accountability or democratic control at all. There's also money, of course, that comes from previous looting and theft from ourselves, the great landed estates, the royal family, and of the plunder of empire. But that also is something which we should look at very carefully. That money should be used for the good of the people in Britain and of good people across the world, I believe.
Perhaps their true power and wealth would be better known if not for their favorite lapdog, the media. Sure, lately the royal family has been the subject of some scrutiny. Still, many mainstream news outlets continue to divert attention from royal scandals or do their best to stop them from reaching the royal family.
The media collaborates in the cover-up. It collaborates in massaging the news in order to downplay anything which is critical of the royal family.
Usually the monarchy can rely on the British press to keep silent on any embarrassing story about the monarchy.
The royal family have a huge amount of influence over the press. They're extremely well connected, and the press pretty much acts as a universal cheerleader for the royal family.
I think the royal family's influence over the press is considerable, and has probably in a way got greater, because the British media has become more and more obsequious, I think, over the last 20 to 30 years. Much more reluctant to criticise, to expose what is going on inside the British establishment.
Every charitable gesture or good work, on the other hand, is magnified. It is the work of PR experts, spin doctors, and the loyal royal correspondents.
The media's sycophantic obsession with anything royal, royal weddings, royal births, only feeds the notion that the royal family matters, either politically or economically. The use, or as I should say misuse, of the media for political power is a tactic deployed by the propagandist social engineer Edward Bernays. Bernays felt that society was dangerous and must be manipulated by elite controllers. He is famous for being the man who got women to smoke. In the early 1920s, smoking was mostly for men, and some places even forbid women from smoking. Bernays, hired by tobacco companies to increase sales, famously paid female models to march in the 1929 Easter Parade, smoking cigarettes branded as torches of freedom. One of his primary tactics was to publicly pair politicians with various celebrities in a clever move to make people associate one with the other.
This goes back to Edward Bernays 100 years ago saying, look, to make politicians and royalty popular, we'll have Hollywood stars come to banquets and events with them. We'll have music stars. We'll have other people go there to basically make these elites be seen as celebrities themselves.
Similar to how we saw the London Olympic Games begin with the Queen being escorted by Daniel Craig as James Bond. Television shows like The Royals capitalize on the public's obsession with royalty, but also perpetuate the notion that hereditary power is part of life, and even looks cool and trendy, when in reality, it is so 17th century. From the time we were children, movies glamorize royalty and portray them as something to be protected. A recent example is The Kingsman, in which an elite group of young wannabe spies compete to see which has the ultimate devotion to the crown. Elaborate tests are created to see if they are willing to die and even kill their own dog for the queen. Seriously? Give your own life for the king and queen? So what? They can hang out with pedophiles like Jimmy Savile, which I'll touch on in a moment? The movie The King's Speech was mostly a sympathy piece about Queen Elizabeth II's dad, King George VII, to distract from the fact that his brother, the would-be king, was a Nazi. See, the Crown Prince, Edward VIII, was a Nazi sympathizer. More on that later. But suffice it to say, he had to abdicate because he was a Nazi and he worked against the Allies during the war. The 2006 Oscar darling, The Queen, starring Helen Mirren, was nothing but one big propaganda piece for the royal family. After the death of Diana, the royal family's image was considerably tarnished, and rightfully so. They basically ignored her death and remained secluded in their Scottish castle. The Oscar-winning movie portrayed a very sympathetic view of the Queen and the royal family during these times, and it was even officially approved by Buckingham Palace. If only hated despots like North Korea's Kim Jong-un could have acclaimed actors like Helen Mirren portray them as sensitive and loving. But hey, they don't wear robes and shiny bling, what do they know? To the royal family, a wedding occasion is nothing but a big PR opportunity.
1 week until the royal wedding, this is exciting stuff. I mean, it's hard to, I mean, the energy is just palpable.
Young couples get married, they're just hoping that some bank will be nice enough to give them a mortgage.
Yeah.
These folks have a number of palaces to pick from.
NBC News is launching a free royal wedding app for the iPad.
Long before the Kardashians, monarchies have been capitalizing on the public's fascination with romance and marriage like only a royal can.
It pumps up all of the kind of bread and circuses nonsense, the Hello magazine type celebrity culture which surrounds them. So there's a royal wedding or there's a royal baby or whatever, and they turn it into a jamboree, which is like something out of ancient Rome or something out of medieval England. I mean, a completely kind of feudal sort of obsession with these extraordinarily rich.
The contract with the BBC to film the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton stipulated that the footage could not be used for humorous or satirical purposes. Australian comedy programme The Chaser had to be pulled from the schedules because it breached that ban.
They conduct these elaborate rituals to entice the public and send a message about the power of the crown. Elegant robes and crowns serve as a reminder of how powerful they are and how little and poor the people are. Much like the old days when barkers and messengers would carry the news of a royal wedding from town to town, national TV outlets carry minute-by-minute royal wedding programming. For most people, a wedding is the most interested they will be in anything royal. The marriage of William and Kate had expected 2 billion viewers worldwide, and U.S. viewership was even higher than anticipated at 23 million viewers. That's 23 million Americans at 7 a.m. on the East Coast. The face value of this gigantic publicity stunt? 34 million. While that would be extravagant by anyone's standards, the royal family's wedding actually cost much, much more. In British tradition, aristocracy marries on a weekday to show they do not have to work. Because of this, the entire nation of UK was off work on the day of the wedding, which actually resulted in an estimated £6 billion loss in productivity. The monarchy has weathered its share of high-profile scandals through the years, but none as shocking as the latest child abuse scandal currently rocking the highest levels of power. In 2011, UK's beloved disc jockey and TV star Jimmy Savile died. Once idolized as a radio TV personality, he was, by many Brits, considered to be a national treasure. Jimmy bragged about his close relationship with the royal family and was even knighted by the Queen in 1990. 1 year after the UK mourned his passing, widely publicized reports began to surface claiming the man so many looked up to and admired had been a serial rapist of prepubescent boys and girls and even some adults. Within months, reports poured into local police stations with horrific rape accusations against the star.
The numbers are bewildering. 450 people have come forward. 328 were children at the time. 214 crimes have been reported, 34 rapes. The youngest victim was 8. And on it goes. Hundreds must have known something.
This guy was a record-breaking pedophile who preyed on victims who were in their weakest state. Many recovering in hospitals or locked in mental facilities where he volunteered.
Savile's abuse continued wherever he went. 50 allegations were made of abuse in 13 hospitals and in one hospice, the Wheatfield Hospice in Leeds, and claims of abuse in 14 schools and, of course, at the BBC.
His relationship with the royal family was even closer than Savile himself let on. He was known to have been a go-between between Prince Charles and Princess Diana while their marriage was on the rocks. He was photographed multiple times with Prince Charles, and he even invited guests to parties on Prince Charles's behalf. Prince Charles even dined at Savile's home and sent him gifts.
Jimmy Savile, child procurer to the elite. He was procuring children for Ted Heath on his yacht Morning Cloud from the now infamous children's home on Jersey. But he was, by his own words, introduced. This is a guy's a disc jockey. And in the end, he wasn't even that. But he, in his own words, he was introduced into the inner sanctum of the royal family by Lord Mountbatten in the 1960s, the mentor of Prince Philip and Prince Charles. And
he said to do favors. I can get them things.
Yeah, Mountbatten is a known paedophile. He was involved in paedophilia at places like the King Cora Boys Home in Belfast and what have you. You ask this question, media, ask yourself this question. What is an aging disc jockey doing in the inner sanctum of the royal family? So close that by his own words, and I know this from other sources who were close, who were very close friends of Princess Diana for 9 years before she died, that he was asked by them to be the go-between and the mediator between Diana and Charles when their marriage was breaking down. What's going on? And I'll tell you how I knew about Savile. This is a very, very interesting story. In 1997, 98, I was asked to go in, to a little meeting at the House of Lords. I'd never even been into the House of Lords. I didn't know what I was going into. And it was just a small group of people. And we just had a chat in the afternoon. But there was somebody there who wasn't from the House of Lords who was saying some very interesting things about the death of Princess Diana. This was about 98, not long after it happened. And I called her over afterwards. I said, how do you know all that? And she says, well, my best friend was the best friend of Diana for 9 years. And they fell out about 2 years before Diana died. She said, I think she'll talk to you. Few weeks later, or days later, she arrives on the island where I live, and I've got all this on tape. It's still at home on tape. What she told me in 1998 was the way that the royal family treated Diana, that Jimmy Savile was in on the inner sanctum of the royal family, and Princess Diana called him a sleazebag, and that he was a necrophiliac.
A teenage boy working at Buckingham Palace revealed he was groomed and sexually abused by a VIP paedophile ring there.
During their marital dispute, whenever Savile would come to Prince Charles's office, he would rub his bottom lip from the bottom of the female assistant's arm all the way up to the elbow. Not only was Savile a record-breaking pedophile himself, he was a procurer of children for the elite circles into which he was invited. He was brought into the inner sanctum by Lord Mountbatten, who is himself linked to a children's home scandal in Belfast and whose huge child porn collection is locked away in the Royal Archive.
The authors of War of the Windsors state that Lord Lewis Mountbatten had the nickname Dicky, and for good reason. Philip's uncle Dicky was the last viceroy in India, where he was a known pedophile who sexually exploited young working-class Indian peasant boys. Another book, The Kinkora Scandal, connects Lord Dicky Mountbatten to a child prostitution vice ring in Belfast, Ireland. Authorities failed to intervene at the Kinkora care home for boys until 1981, despite reports over the years of child sexual abuse. The operators of the Kinkora child prostitution ring were eventually convicted in 1981 of the ritual sexual abuse of defenseless young boys who were sold like prostitutes.
The children's home, called Kinkora, turned out to be nothing but one big boy brothel, ran by pedophiles who then trafficked and sold these boys to the rich and powerful. How would an aging disc jockey work his way into the intimate relationships of the royal family and even become knighted? The truth is best put by the man himself. When asked about his relationship with the royal family, he said, "You see, the thing about me is, I get things done, and I work deep." But if close ties to the world's greatest known pedophile wasn't enough, the royals were about to be shaken by their greatest scandal yet. Enter charming billionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, the international financier and convicted sex offender whose address book read like a who's who of A-list celebrities, scientists, politicians, and bankers. But his penchant for young girls sent his opulent lifestyle into a tailspin when reports of his elite parties at what the press dubbed his Orgy Island got out. He had an island in the Virgin Islands that he was using to bring elites from all walks of life. Powerful figures, including Bill Clinton and Kevin Spacey, were flown to have a wild time. These elites were being filmed or photographed so that Epstein would be able to blackmail them later on. One of Epstein's closest partners in crime was none other than the Queen's son, Prince Andrew. In 2015, a photograph surfaced clearly depicting Prince Andrew with an underage girl. The victim claimed she was paid $400 to have sex with Prince Andrew. For this, she was groomed well. Epstein's assistant, who scouted the girls for Epstein, took the victim, Virginia Roberts, to buy new clothes and even a $1,000 purse, and remarked about her need to impress the prince. Epstein trained the girls to collect as much information as they possibly could. The victim described Prince Andrew's foot fetish to Epstein and noted Epstein appeared to be collecting private information about Prince Andrew.
It is the worst possible start to the new year for Prince Andrew. This is him leaving his ski chalet in Switzerland early to head back to the UK to consult with lawyers. The lurid allegations go back more than a decade. The Duke of York has been named in court papers filed in the United States by Virginia Roberts, who was 17 then and is 30 now. They are the most serious allegations a member of the royal family has faced in years. It is a friendship with this man which is coming back to haunt Prince Andrew. Financier Jeffrey Epstein was convicted of procuring a girl for prostitution, and this picture was taken after he came out of jail.
It may surprise you to learn the British royal family isn't even British. They are actually a German family by the name of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, and they changed their name in 1917 because England was fighting Germany in World War I. Their name, Windsor itself, has nothing to do with the royal family and comes from one of their castles. When Prince Charles married a commoner, Diana, she had more British blood than he, but the British ruling family never gave up their German heritage or sympathies. Some members even going so far as to secretly side with Hitler and the Nazis during World War II. In 1941, as war rages between the United Kingdom and Germany, Rudolf Hess, deputy Führer to Hitler himself, makes an emergency parachute landing in Scotland. With him are plans for peace between Great Britain and the fascist Nazi party. Once discovered, he is locked in the tower for the rest of his life. But what led a high-ranking Nazi and member of Hitler's inner circle to believe he could succeed in such an ambitious endeavor? Could it be that Hitler believed England would be willing to make peace? If so, such an idea could have only come from one person. Edward VIII abdicated in 1936, supposedly to marry the love of his life, a man-crazed divorced actress portrayed in the movie The King's Speech. However, history shows a much darker motive. Monarchies across Europe had taken notice of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, which saw the death of the entire Russian royal family. As a result, many were quick to see fascism as a way of preserving the monarchy, and were likely to harbor Nazi sympathies. Pictures recently surfaced showing Edward and the Queen Mother teaching the future Queen Elizabeth II to do a Nazi salute. Edward was himself a Nazi sympathizer and met with Hitler right before the war in 1937, as Germany was preparing for an all-out assault on Europe. He posed for publicity photos with Hitler's closest henchmen, including Goebbels, Himmler, and Goring, as well as the Führer himself. He was to take over as king again should England lose to Germany and act as Hitler's puppet. The royal family essentially had all their bases covered. If they lost, Edward would be king with his divorced wife, and they, at least, would still be in power. Even after abdicating, he made pro-Nazi speeches critical of England's involvement at a press statement in which he openly called for peace. When war first broke out between England and Germany, Edward was given a symbolic position within the Naval Intelligence Agency to make it seem as if he was doing something in regards to the war effort. But in reality, Churchill had to be careful and make sure Edward never received any real intelligence, otherwise it would quickly find itself in Nazi hands. Frustrated by deliberately being left out of the loop, he quit the intelligence department. Churchill then moved him around the world, from Spain to the Bahamas, to keep him away from the Nazis, where he could not do any harm to the war effort. Still, he managed to take a vacation to America, in which he planned on meeting with President Roosevelt in order to discuss Germany's peaceful intentions. Roosevelt, however, would have none of it, and even had the FBI tail the prince wherever he went during his well-publicized Miami excursion. For all their Nazi connections, you would think the royal family would try to distance themselves from the Third Reich as much as possible, but nothing would be further from the truth. Prince Harry created quite a stir a while back when he dressed in complete Nazi regalia to a party. A subtle tip of the hat to his uncle, perhaps? But it was Philip himself who trained as a child in the Nazi youth and founded the World Wildlife Federation, a depopulation organization, alongside Nazi SS officer Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands.
The boy is called Philip. His full name is Philip Schleswig Holstein Sonderberg Glucksberg, and he grew up in Germany. He was raised amongst his Nazi in-laws, some of whom later became high-ranking members of the SS. His Nazi relatives then sent him to this school in southern Germany, where he studied for a while under the Nazi curriculum. Philip later recalled that there was much heel-clicking and shouts of Heil Hitler were compulsory. And here's Philip, in Darmstadt, in the heart of Germany, in November 1937, attending a family funeral for some of his Nazi in-laws. Marching in front of a Sieg Heiling crowd, this is Philip, next to Christoph, his SS brother-in-law, and Philip, his Nazi stormtrooper brother-in-law. Imagine if a man with a past like this had somehow ended up marrying into British aristocracy. Well, he did. And as we know, he got first prize. He became the Duke of Edinburgh, also known as Prince Philip, after marrying Princess Elizabeth, the future Queen of England.
In fact, all of Philip's sisters married high-ranking Nazis. The British royal family has good reasons for admiring Hitler and the Nazis. The eugenics ideas that led to genocide and sterilization were based on them. Francis Galton, the progenitor of eugenics, studied the British royal family and concluded that their positions were the result of superior genes. These ideas led to mass sterilization in many countries across the West during the 30s, including the US. Today, scientists and global power brokers continue to push for depopulation, basically the extermination of undesirables under the guise of overpopulation. The royal family is at the forefront of depopulation agendas worldwide. Prince Charles is a key voice in the overpopulation movement. He flies around the world lecturing developing nations about using too much energy. Meanwhile, he lives in a palace. He gives speeches where he can be heard saying things like, "Sanctity of life should be placed in balance with the need to live within the limits of nature. The earth can't sustain us all." Perhaps the most outspoken advocate for depopulation is the Queen's husband, Prince Philip. Prince Philip famously stated that if he were to be reincarnated, he would like to return as a deadly virus to kill as many humans as he can. Seriously, this is a serious comment made during an interview. In another interview he gave, he essentially said that large families should be curbed to control food costs. This man has an obvious hatred for humanity. The preface to one of his books is all about how he grew up on a hunting estate and how he learned at an early age the importance of culling the surplus population. He continues to give speeches extolling the need for population reduction around the globe. No member of the royal family caught the fascination and adoration of the public quite like Princess Diana. With her charm and grace, she captured the hearts of millions worldwide. Many, however, would be shocked to hear how she was treated by the royal family. Diana was, essentially, nothing but a well-kept broodmare, living in a gilded cage. Diana was chosen partly because she came from the right stock. Diana's father was the 8th Earl of Spencer, descended from the 5th Earl of Spencer, who was a groom of the stool. The groom of the stool is responsible not for stools like you sit on, but for stool as in feces. That's right, the groom of the stool was the person who wiped the king after he went to the bathroom. This is an actual position that existed within the royal court and continued until recently.
It's called the groom of the stool. And a British lord follows the queen or king, depending on what it is around, follows them around, and they set up in this big cabinet, and they have to fly it around with her. This has been on the news. That's why they fly it around. They claim they stopped it in 1906, but deeper research shows they're just very quiet about it, and millions of pounds are spent a year to move this portable toilet around, because it's got to be big enough. She goes up on a throne and craps. I'm sorry, this is real, folks. I'm not groom of the stool. Google it. And they wipe her fat butt. Aaron Dykes.
And that's not some lowly chimney sweep either. That's in the British hierarchy. That's a lordly high up position, right?
It has to be one of the top lords. This is the most coveted position. See, it's all about worshiping them. And then, I don't want to get into more detail, but then they pick with their bare hands, with respect, and examine it. And then every stool and every jar of urine, it's not put into water, that would defile it, is stored. And all of the royalty stool, going back over 500 years, is stored. Now this came from France, And in French, it's just the French version of Grim of the Stool. So this disgusting bucket of pus, this maggot-ridden Nazi piece of filth, gets up there every day and people wipe her disgusting hind end. Anyways, the point is yes, they had, well, their pus was so holy. It came out of their festering wounds, it had to be sucked.
And if by any chance you were interested in knowing how the king wiped his bottom, well, he'd actually got someone to sort that sort of thing out for him. He was known as the groom of the stool.
The monarch's body was sacred. Only the most aristocratic hands were worthy to disappear beneath the royal buttocks. So the groom of the stool had a lot of power in exchange for his revolting job. Though, as a career tactic, it gives a whole new meaning to brown nosing.
OK, here's our retiring room, just adjacent to the king's bedchamber. Here's the box, which looks rather like something a magician might use, and in a way I suppose it is. Who's going to be the king?
Your Majesty.
So you do all the rest, right?
Yeah, indeed. What you're sitting on now is a modern replica of a box that Henry VIII would have used on a daily basis. It's this stool is, in fact, like one in his inventory, 1547, after his death.
The million-dollar question, do you actually wipe the royal bum?
Well, of course, yeah. Yeah, because you're not just a king. You are a divine body on Earth. You are divinely appointed. Therefore, there's no Tom, Dick or Harry that touches your body. It has to be a trusted nobleman.
So this is quite a high-status job.
Oh, it's the highest job within the royal household. Amongst courtiers, you've got people like the Chancellor who are running the country. But within the palaces themselves, the groom of the stool is the most important next to the king.
High status, but not that pleasant.
Indeed so, yeah. Well, but Henry VIII created this body called the Privy Chamber after 1519, which drew its members from noblemen. So I'm one of a privileged few, and, you know, the royal backside is you know, all part of the job for me.
And Henry would have been pretty crotchety, wouldn't he? An
increasingly vicious person to be around. Of course, the closer you are to him, in a sense, the more dangerous it was. And Henry Norris, the groom of the stool in the mid-1530s, was implicated in Anne Boleyn's infidelities. So he hit the dirt. I'm going to have all this kit to hand, because although making the bed can be regimented every morning, your bowel movements can't. And, in fact, with other accoutrements, like this this pewter little flagon there, and a bowl and plate, all these things are written down in what's called the Baby's Book of Nurture, which is a late 15th century book telling you how to take care of noble people. This is how to run a court.
So I just give the shout.
Yeah.
There you are.
Indeed. And with my diaper cloth draped over my shoulder.
When you say diaper, is that like an American diaper?
No. Exactly that. It's because it's woven in two ways. It's extra thick. And the diamond pattern is diaper. It's very good, very absorbent for the royal backside.
But it was a pretty fat backside, wasn't it?
It was. You were spreading a bit, I think, by the late 1530s.
Heavy meat diet?
Very heavy indeed, yeah. And do you know what I'd need to do? Probably administer an enema once in a while.
An enema?
And
oh, my God.
Who needs friends when you've got enemas? In 1539, it was reported by Sir Thomas Henage, the then groom of the stool, that the king had had a very fair siege after being administered with laxatives and an enema.
A siege?
A siege, a passage of stools.
Groom my stool!
The daughter of the Earl of Spencer and descended from a great line of ass wipers, Diana was not a stranger to the royal family and met Prince Charles at a polo match when she was 16. For all their fairy tale romance splattered across the newspapers and magazines, theirs was not a relationship of love. When asked by a reporter on their wedding day if they were in love, Charles remarked, "Whatever in love means." Charles cheated openly on Diana with Camilla Parker Bowles, and Diana, in return, had her own affairs. One such affair was a bodyguard named Barry Manicky. Barry was killed in an unexplained motorcycle crash after rumors of their affairs got out. Diana was told by Prince Charles that the same could happen to you. Major James Hewitt, one of Diana's lovers, was also threatened by the royal family if he did not stop his relationship with Diana.
Were they threatening?
Yes. They were, inasmuch as they said that it was not conducive to my health to continue the relationship.
Members of the royal household told him that his safety would be in peril If he did not back off, anonymous telephone calls warned him that he would meet the same fate as Barry Manicky. He said that the Princess of Wales took the threat seriously and told him that Manicky had been murdered.
This was the friend of the person I met at Parliament who came to my house and I interviewed her on tape at length. Her name was Christine Fitzgerald. She was a friend of Diana and acknowledged to be so by the media for about 9 years. But what she told me about the rituals and what goes on at places like Balmoral Castle and all was just beyond belief, but true. Now,
say it, tell it.
Well, I mean, literally sacrificing children, drinking their blood and all that stuff that they go on.
Hey, I've been told by people that just went to Oxford who are famous, but I can't say their names, that they did devil worship and mass orgies.
Yeah, but it's the norm at that so-called level.
Oh, no, that's low level.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's far more prevalent than anyone believes. That's the trouble. But the thing is that what she told me was that, first of all, this is 1998, that she was an alternative healer, and Diana used to go to her for healing and stuff like that, because she had nobody else. She was just on her own in the middle of that Adams family, that evil Adams family we call the Windsors. Anyway, what she called friendly people at MI5 were doing were leaving notes for Diana, knowing that when she came, she could pick them up. And one of these notes, and this is why the Paul Burrell letter about, you know, Diana saying that my husband is going to kill me in a car crash, that didn't surprise me at all. I'd heard about that years before, in the sense of these MI5 notes, some of them were warning Diana that the royal family wanted her dead. Now, the royal family wouldn't kill people. Well, just hold on a second. What happened when the marriage of Diana and Charles broke down is that she started having an affair with her bodyguard called Barry Manicky. She was apparently very, very much in love with the fella. Then Barry Manicky dies in a strange motorcycle accident in which he was basically garroted across the road and pulled off his bike and killed. Now, it was said.
And here's the headline, Daily Mail, Diana bodyguard killed for our affair.
Yeah. What the official story was that it was an accident. Anyway, this is what Christine Fitzgerald told me happened subsequently, sometime later. Diana came into her healing center just near Regent's Park in London in an inconsolable state. She was sobbing. And it took some time to sit her down and calm her down and say, what's going on? Because as she was sobbing, Diana was shouting, they killed him, they killed him, they killed him. And what Diana then said is that earlier that day, hence the response, what she called Prince Charles's senior detective had said to her, because by this time, it's sometime after the death of the bodyguard, she was having an affair with a man now out and accepted in the open, with a guy called Captain James Hewitt. And she said that what had happened is the senior detective of Prince Charles had just said to her that the affair with Hewitt had to end, and if it didn't, he could end up like Barry Manicky, which is the bodyguard that's supposed to have been an accident. He was telling her they killed her. He also said to her in the same conversation, and don't think that you're not expendable either. And Diana told her the story whereby when she'd first heard about Barry Manicky, was when she was with Charles in a limo being driven to the steps of an airplane, and outside were all the paparazzi. And just as they were about to get out, she said, Charles leaned across and said, pity about your friend, wasn't it? And told her with a smile on his face and an irony in his voice that Barry Manicky had just died. And so they killed the guy. That's what happens. And at the same time, this came out in the public arena as well, James Hewitt was being warned by what he called a senior member of the royal family that...
And tell folks who that is.
James Hewitt, he was the guy who had the affair later with Diana. And he said publicly that a senior member of the royal family had contacted him and said the affair must end, or in effect they can't be, they can't say what the consequences would be. In other words, he was being threatened in the same way. The royal family, the Windsors, are an evil intergenerational bloodline.
She was considered a loose cannon by the royal family, who still viewed her as a commoner and treated her coldly. So much so that Diana even referred to the royal family as lizards and snakes, and insisted that they weren't human. When it came time to birth their first child, the labor had to be induced to fit Charles's polo schedule. After an heir and a spare, it was a quick divorce. Diana's was a life spent under intense media scrutiny, and yet she managed to epitomize all the elegance and courage that a fairy tale princess should have. She was, in every regard, the people's princess. And so it was on that fateful August day that Diana took with her not only the baby she was carrying, but so many of her hearts as well. Diana was widely believed to be pregnant at the time of the crash with Dodi Al-Fayed's baby. Now, more evidence than ever points to the royal family as the cause of that deadly crash. So much so that over half the British population now believe the Princess of Wales' death was no accident. She had even gone so far as to warn friends in writing, "I will be killed in a car crash set up by Charles." We know now that a bright light was deployed as her car entered the tunnel, which stunned the driver, causing him to swerve and strike one of the concrete columns. But Diana was not dead. Reports now show that Princess Diana was alive when the ambulance got to the tunnel. But once the ambulance arrived, it still took hours to get her out. Much speculation has been made about what was happening in that tunnel during those hours, but one thing's for sure. Of the many cameras in and around the tunnel, all of them were either malfunctioning or turned off on the night of the crash. What we do know is that after the ambulance left the tunnel, it took the slow route, passing at least four hospitals on the way. Mohammed Al-Fayed, the billionaire former owner of Harrods department store, is convinced his son and the princess were killed.
Like horse breeding, royal lineage is all about bloodlines. They'd regarded Diana as nothing more than a brood mare crossed with a clothes horse, but she turned out to be a kicker, getting her oats by being covered by an Arab stallion. And Mohammed thinks that was sufficient motive for the royals to decide it was time to send them all to the knacker's yard.
They have murdered my son and Princess Diana. And I put my finger straight to the gangster who ruling the country behind the scene, who is the head of the royal household, Prince Philip.
The royal family's behavior after the death did nothing to quell rumors of their involvement. Away from mourners in London at their Balmoral Castle, they remained silent and stoic as the nation around them grieved. They even refused to fly the flag at Buckingham Palace for days. After hearing of Diana's death, the Queen coyly replied, "Someone must have greased the brakes." The royal family simply could not have the future Queen Mother be married to a Muslim, and so she was done away with. For centuries, rumors have swirled around the royal family, claiming that their infamous lineage is actually inbred. Not only are the rumors true, the situation is actually far worse than most have heard. Genealogists actually consider the royal family to be a distinct subgroup due to generations of inbreeding. Dating back to the time of the ancients, rulers have believed they rule because of divine blood, and they would often marry only members of their own family.
Well, the royals always saw themselves as a race apart. This is why royals married other royals, why they would never allow any marriage out of a royal family. It didn't matter if a princess was ugly or stupid or ill or anything. As long as she was a member of a royal family, this is really what was most important.
The British royal family are no exception. Queen Elizabeth II is married to her second cousin, Philip, just as Queen Victoria married her second cousin. Charles and Diana were actually 11th cousins, as were William and Kate. This much inbreeding in one family is not without its biological repercussions, both physical and mental.
Burke's Peerage is a prestigious directory that records the who's who lineage of the British aristocracy. It falsely recorded that the Queen's first cousins, Nerissa and Catherine, died in 1940 and 1961.
Every family has secrets they would rather the world not know. even the most famous of them all. At every family occasion over the past 70 years, two of the Queen's cousins have been absent from the feast, declared dead to family and society.
We were sworn to secrecy. This is something that we didn't talk about.
All the staff were put on, you know, be quiet, don't say anything.
For decades, the cousins remained hidden in an institution for so-called mental defectives.
It just seemed a waste of life. This way, I couldn't put a child of mine into a place like that, whatever they was going to be like.
Many thousands of others, condemned as idiots and imbeciles, shared their fate and were hidden out of sight and out of mind.
In those days, people weren't interested in learning disability people. They were just put there because of shame.
But the royal secret was exposed.
Afternoon, ladies. Nice to see you all.
A private investigator's hidden camera revealed the truth.
Where's Catherine? Somebody said I should have a word with her this afternoon.
Catherine Bowes-Lyon, niece to the Queen Mother and cousin to the Queen, is still alive today. Sheila Rule had cared for Nerissa and Catherine for over a decade and was one of the few to attend Nerissa's funeral.
Well, at Nerissa's funeral, there was no family present. It was only staff. And Catherine went. She didn't cry or anything, but she was quiet. She was quiet. Of course, she must feel like there's something not right.
There was no connection with the royalty, and that's no credit to them. They could have given her a very lavish funeral, really, but they didn't. And she had a pauper's grave.
Some diseases caused by royal inbreeding are more gruesome in nature. In the 16th century, rumors spread throughout villages of grotesque ruling families who drank blood and consumed human flesh. Recent reports have come to light showing the royal family has a long history of consuming not only human blood, but meat as well. Long known for their love of lavish banquets, what is less well known is the British royals' taste for human meat. A new book on medicinal cannibalism has revealed that British royalty consumed parts of the human body. Reports claim that it ended in the time of Queen Victoria, but we know that in fact it did not. If only Jeffrey Dahmer had been a royal, then he would truly have been celebrated. But their cannibalistic behavior can be better understood when you realize that inbred people often develop a bizarre disease called porphyria.
Porphyria is a royal blood disorder caused by the mixing of aristocratic boyar houses with the Slavic regal bloodlines that produced a genetic ailment that has been suggested as an explanation for the origin of vampire werewolf legends, based upon a number of similarities between the conditions and folklore that was first speculated upon by biochemist David Dolphin in 1985. Porphyria cutanata tarda presents clinically as a pathological sensitivity of skin exposed to light, causing scarring, hair growth and disfiguration. Additionally, it was believed that the patient's missing blood could be absorbed through the stomach, correlating with legends of hematocophagy. This is otherwise known as the vampiric feeding upon fresh blood.
Strangely enough, these monstrous symptoms can actually be treated by consuming human blood, which is likely where the first legends of vampirism began. Indeed, Bram Stoker based his stories of Count Dracula on Vlad the Impaler. Prince Charles is a direct descendant of Vlad the Impaler, and brags about how great the Count was, and even lives in Romania, where the castle is part of the year.
Distant past.
The genealogy shows that I'm descended from Vlad the Impaler, you see. So I do have a bit of a stake in the country.
As it were.
Prince Charles even goes to Loch Nagar, or Goat's Lake, near the royal castle of Balmoral, where he claims to draw his spiritual power. Royal incest has, throughout the centuries, led to many genetic diseases, none quite as infamous as hemophilia. Hemophilia was passed to the British royal family, again, through the Russian line. Again, these conditions can be temporarily relieved by drinking human blood. This practice of consuming human victims led to rampant rumors of vampires among villagers, and warnings not to go near the castle. With her stolen cash, outrageous bling, and murderous record, the Queen is undoubtedly the original gangster. But no gangster would be complete without an arrest warrant, and Her Majesty has one of those as well. Enter the Hamloops Catholic Boarding School for Aboriginals, British Columbia, 1964. The school is at a frenzy. For days, they have been frantically preparing for a visit from the Queen herself. The children have been washed and given new clothes for the first time in weeks. She arrived with surprisingly little fanfare before selecting a group of students to accompany Prince Philip and herself on a picnic. The ones she chose seemed to be the smarter kids of the class. Along with a priest, the group made their way to a meadow beside a nearby creek, where each child was made to bow and kiss Queen Elizabeth's foot. After the picnic, she was seen leaving with 10 of the Aboriginal children, 7 boys and 3 girls. They were never seen or heard from again.
Here is Kevin Annette, a pastor who's been warning about the abuse of children in Canada, but with links back to Britain, he's now been banned from Britain.
And links to the Crown as well. Our Queen and Prince Philip going out to Canada and taking 10 children from the smart class of a school, and those kids never being seen again, and made to kiss our Queen's feet.
An eyewitness, William Coombs, died suddenly while undergoing routine tests not long after giving his testimony to a local radio show.
William Coombs shuffles into the Ovaltine Cafe on Vancouver's Hastings Street Skid Row with his few belongings stuffed in a backpack. He nods and smiles at me, for we haven't seen each other in weeks. "I've been drinking again, really bad," he begins apologetically, for he knows how much I rely on him and how he relies on that reliance. "The memories again?" I ask. "Yeah, but it's like now I ain't got nowhere to talk about it. Not now, with your radio show gone. That was the way I got by, talking on the show." I nod, remembering with more than anger how his lifeline was severed so brutally. I say quickly, "I've got a new show, a blog radio program. You have to come on it." He looks at me wearily, then reaches into his bag and extracts a nearly empty bottle and swigs from it. We let the minutes tick by, hoping for something. Finally, William says, "Remember when the Queen came to our school? How she took away those 10 kids?" "Yeah, I checked on that. She was definitely in BC in the fall of 64. I remember their names, some of them, the boys. I pull out my notepad. There was Harvey and Ralph Parker, Métis boys from Lytton. They were in the group taken away by the Queen and Philip after the picnic at Dead Man's Creek. 5 other boys went, and 3 girls. They were all in the smart group in school. The 10 children were never seen again. Oh, you remember anything else, William?" I asked. He nods sadly. "George Adolf and Ralph Arnous, they were with me that day. They saw the kids taken away, and how she made them all kiss her foot." "What?" "The Queen had on these white gloves, and she put out her foot and told all those 10 kids they had to kiss it. They all did." William shuddered and started coughing. "I started talking about it the next day in school, said it wasn't right. Then the nun told me if I said anything against the Queen, I'd get killed for it."
Coombs was scheduled to testify before the Common Law Court of Justice in Brussels concerning the matter, but he never made it. Nevertheless, an order to arrest Queen Elizabeth II was issued in 2013 by 6 judges of the International Common Law Court of Justice in Brussels. After nearly a year of litigation, Queen Elizabeth II and her husband, Prince Philip, were found guilty in the disappearance of 10 native children from the Catholic-run Kamloops Residential School in British Columbia. Grieving parents haven't seen their children since they left for a picnic with the royal couple on October 10th, 1964. Arrest warrants like these will never be answered to by the Queen. But this is not the first time the Queen has been connected to missing people. In 2012, the body of a teenage girl who had been missing for over a year was found at the Queen's Sandringham estate. Evidence suggests she was the victim of a murder, and that the body had been there roughly 4 months. That time frame would place the time of death around the Druidic holiday of Mabon. Mabon is widely celebrated by occult enthusiasts, but none more so than the Druids with whom the holiday originated. Queen Elizabeth can be seen in a rare photograph showing her in full Celtic regalia, continuing the ancient Druidic traditions in a ceremony before her coronation. On this important ritual day, the ancient Celtics would sacrifice a human burned alive in a giant wicker man. Perhaps someone just got sloppy with the last Mabon sacrifice. But this isn't the first time Her Majesty has a body turn up on her property. An American by the name of Robert James Moore was found dead on a strange hand-built hut on an island right outside of Buckingham Palace. He was described as having an obsession with the Queen. For 15 years, he had been sending offensive letters and packages to her and had been living on a nearby island to spy on the palace. This island is somewhat inaccessible. You have to swim out to it, but locals described it as having the perfect view of the palace. From there, you would be able to see all the comings and goings of the royal family. The coroner on this case described it as, quote, an excellent, unimpeded view of the palace. His body had been there for years before it was discovered by tree trimmers on the island. By this time, only a skeleton remained, but the medical examiner was careful to avoid ruling out foul play, calling his death undetermined. What had Moore seen on his Robin Crusoe-style voyeur's nest, and could it have played a role in his untimely demise? It would appear murderous, cannibalistic royals are still very much alive today.
The royal protocol should be offensive to any free humanist. When you meet the princess, bow slightly at the waist. Don't look in her eye. Do not offer your hand unless she offers her first. Gosh, I hope all that blends well with my protocol where the people I meet have to blow me.
A queen! We have to call her things like Your Majesty! Your Majesty! Like she's all majestic, like an eagle or a mountain. She's just a person, a little old lady in a shiny hat that we paid for. Or Your Highness! What the fuck is that? What, she's high up, above us, at the top of a class pyramid, on a shelf of money with her own face on it? We should be calling her Mrs. Windsor. In fact, that's not even her real name. They changed it in the war to distract us from the inconvenient fact that they were as German as the enemy that teenage boys were being encouraged, conscripted actually, to die fighting. Her actual name is Mrs. Saxa Coburg Gotha. Mrs. Saxa Coburg Gotha? No wonder they fucking changed it. It's the most German thing I've ever heard. She might as well have been called Mrs. Bratwurst Kraut Nazi. Titles have got to go. I'm not calling her Your Highness or Your Majesty just so we can pretend there isn't and hasn't always been an international cabal of rich landowners flitting merrily across the globe, getting us all to kill each other a couple of times a decade. From now on, she's Frau Saxa Coburg Gotha.